Maybe a break in the rain Saturday.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He's secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I realize that if I took issue with all the stupid, truly stupid, inane stuff that is done by governments here in the Pacific Northwest, I'd have to have a show that was 100 hours a day long. And so I can't do that. But occasionally, there are some of these that just strike me as so meaningless, so much virtue signaling, that I've got to put them in front of you. And this latest one involves Seattle. Seattle has decided to spend tens of thousands of dollars creating hundreds of signs. And do you know what the signs say? I'll give you the full details in a moment. But they basically say ICE is not allowed to engage in enforcement of federal immigration laws at this spot. And the reason they're picking those spots is they are public property that is open to the public. Now, the stuff that is closed off to the public, and there is plenty of government property that is closed off to everybody except those authorized to go there. Think of the back door or the back rooms of police agencies, sheriff's offices, courthouses, judges' chambers. There are lots of places that are already locked off and not available. They're only talking about the land that is already open to the public. But then they're going to turn around and suggest to ICE, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, you're not allowed to do your stuff here because we don't like your stuff. Now, I want to dig into why that is so colossally stupid and ask the question, why should any city, and let alone in this case Seattle, be spending tens of thousands of dollars? That's just to make these 656 signs and then put them up all over the place. They haven't even included, what is this going to cost to send city crews out to put all these signs up? And if they don't get stolen right away, and that's a real danger, then is anybody from the federal government even going to pay attention to them? I would suggest that they are not. But first, welcome to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. We endeavor to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on a daily basis, Monday through Friday. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, boy, we love naysayers. And in an election year, even an off-election year, like a midterm election year, we get more than our share of naysayer calls, and I'm glad to take them. You get to go right to the front of the line as long as you can explain expeditiously what is it we disagree with you about that makes you a naysayer. And number two, will you stick around to answer a couple of questions from me, perhaps in the interest of showing that your naysayer position is not well-founded. In any case, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And then there's our X poll. Now, this one kind of struck me because it involves a teacher, a much-beloved teacher. He happened to be in the state of Georgia. It involves some pranks that were being put on the teacher by students. And apparently, there's a long-standing tradition of this kind of pranking that goes on, except the teacher ended up dead. And then charges were laid originally against four or five of the students. And I want to explain what happened and how it happened, why the man, Jason Hughes, the teacher, knew about the prank, knew that it was going to happen, and he wanted to take part. He wanted to go out and catch the kids in the act. In other words, he was having fun with the kids, only it had been raining, he slipped and fell, and he happened to slip and fall right in front of one of the vehicles, and he ended up losing his life. And I think to his credit, his family has said, we don't want those teenagers charged. It was an accident. Now, oftentimes you hear that from the parents of the teenagers. In this case, you're hearing it from the family of the man who died, the family of the teacher who knew the students were coming. He was in his house, and he said, I'll go out and I'll pretend to catch them in the act. He slipped. He fell. There was an accident. And when the kids hit the teacher as he lay in the roadway. And it was an accident. They stopped immediately. They rendered aid. They did what they could do, but they could not save his life. And his family, I think to their credit, have said, we don't want the kids to be charged. So a man died during a senior prank gone wrong. Should the teens involved in that deadly prank still face charges? My answer to that is no. You can answer the question any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, let me go back to Seattle. This is more of the insanity that both Portland and Seattle, and to a lesser extent, some of the other major Northwest cities have been playing. They've been playing the sanctuary game. Oregon, as a state, has been playing the sanctuary game longer than any other state out of the 50 states of the United States. 58 if you're an Obama voter, but 50 for the rest of us who know the geography. So, what are they doing? They want to stand in the way of ICE doing the job. And they actually can't figure out a way to do that, and there's one simple reason for that. The Constitution gives all of the authority, and federal law gives all of the authority, to enforce immigration law to the federal government, and specifically not to the states. In fact, there were states as recently as, you know, Obama's term in office, who said, if you're not going to enforce your laws, we will. Arizona tried to do that. They went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they lost. So the cities have been trying to figure out, how can we get in the way of enforcement of federal immigration law? Well, under the supremacy law, supremacy clause of the Constitution, federal law always trumps local laws. So what is Seattle deciding to do? They've actually sent out a staff memo, and they want to post 656 signs on city property. Just making the signs alone is going to cost $45,000. Which kind of makes you wonder, wow, they're spending a lot to make those signs. And the signs effectively say you're not allowed to engage in enforcement of immigration laws or stage your efforts on this property. Well, the problem is it's public property. In other words, it's open to you. It's open to me. It's open to anybody who wants to go there and walk on that property or park a car or anything else you want to do. So it's a stupid thing to do, number one. Number two, I don't think it's really going to impede ICE in enforcing those laws at all. What is more likely to impede them was the unanimous vote by the Seattle City Council to actually tell the police, already outnumbered by the criminals, to tell the police, you're going to go out and video everything that ICE does, and you're going to try to find something ICE is doing that breaks the law, and then, presumably, they're going to go out and arrest some of the ICE officers. I can see that ending in a colossal and perhaps even dangerous kind of end result. If you're going to have one police agency in America actually trying to take action against another police agency, that is the kind of collision the city of Seattle is trying to do. And so at this point, the city has now indicated to the Center Square, the Center Square is reporting on this has been good. The city of Seattle may need to delay or defer actual transportation projects or programs because of the expense of installing hundreds of signs warning that city property can't be used by federal authorities for immigration enforcement. It is that crazy. Back in a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Speak now or forever hold your peace. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Marriage means a lot to many of us, especially Christians and conservatives. It forms the bedrock for children and families and, frankly, life. For liberal Democrats, not so very much. For them, apparently, marriage just offers a tool for politics and money. How else do you explain why Democrats in Olympia, presumably representing their constituents at home, just passed a massive new income tax with a gigantic penalty on married couples? It's not bad enough that the unnecessary tax supplies cash for a state government addicted to spending beyond our means. Well, now state lawmakers from the Slavery Party have included a penalty for being married. Let me explain. You see, the new tax applies only to millionaires. If you make less than $1 million, you don't pay the tax at all. If two workers each earn paychecks of $750,000 each, they are exempt from the millionaire tax. But if they are married, their household income totals $500,000 over the limit, so they'd pay a $50,000 marriage penalty thanks to the Democrat Party. Democrats in Olympia work overtime to find new ways to drive sensible people out of the state of Washington. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and get better fast at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Jim Butterfield writes in, Lars, last night on the local news, we heard that Portland State University has a shortfall, $35 million. They've also noticed a decline in students of about 25% since 2019. Question, at what point when you see lower enrollment do you start cutting expenses? Also this morning on your flagship radio station, KXL, I heard they're cutting diversity. Wait. I thought it was so important to have diversity. Laugh out loud. Only in Portland. Have a great show. Signed, Jim Butterfield. And my favorite post on X today. This is incredible. Yesterday, I spent considerable time talking about the attempted bombing outside the mayor's home in New York City. Now, CNN, of course, the Chicken Noodle News Network or Clinton News Network, depending on which time period we're talking about, CNN's original post after the ISIS-inspired jihadi bomb-throwing incident outside the mayor's home in New York City. Listen to this. They actually put this up on social media. Now, they tried to erase it, but as all of us know, if once you put something on the internet, once you put something on social media, it never, ever truly goes away. But here's what CNN wrote about the attempted bomb throwing by a couple of jihadis who have confessed their crime to the police. They don't even mind admitting what they did. In fact, they told police investigators, we had hoped that this would be more deadly than the Boston Marathon bombing. But here's what CNN put up to report the story, which tells you why CNN's numbers are down so far. Quote, two Pennsylvania teenagers crossed into New York City Saturday morning for what could have been a normal day enjoying the city during abnormally warm weather. But in less than an hour, their lives would change dramatically as the pair would be arrested for throwing homemade bombs during an anti-Muslim protest outside Mayor Zohran Mamdani's home. Now, I got to tell you something. The protest was a number of people saying, we don't want New York City to be taken over by Muslims. Why is that relevant now? Because the city now has a Muslim communist mayor named Zohran Mamdani. Now, who threw the bombs? Well, that wasn't an anti-Muslim bomb thrower. That was a pro-Muslim jihadi bomb thrower. But don't let the facts get in the way of a good post by CNN. Apparently, they were so ashamed by it, they actually took the darn thing down. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, I'm going to give the Daily Grill to a young lady by the name of Lynn Peterson, and she has an interesting job. And I'll remind you that last week we were talking about a different member of the Metro Regional Government Council. That woman was actually doing her job from Spain about half of every year and just merely checking in by Zoom, you know, checking in by video and internet, and yet still collecting a full-time paycheck of almost $70,000 a year plus benefits. Well, now we find about another deadbeat, and this is the way the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper reported it. Metro's top elected official has missed one-third of her council meetings and may leave before her term ends. At this point, I want to say parenthetically, If you decide to run for a public office and you tell the voters, I will serve your interests for whatever the term of office is. It could be 2 years in the House of Representatives. It could be 6 years in the U.S. Senate. It might be 4 years as a judge. You owe it to the voters to finish your commitment. Instead, 2 days after Metro announced Council President Lynn Peterson may step down before the end of her second term to become the interim city manager of Lake Oswego, Peterson didn't show up at Metro's regular Thursday meeting. Instead, she was excused for what they call personal reasons, according to her staff. Her absence wasn't entirely unusual. Since the start of 2025, Peterson, who draws a public salary of $204,000 a year, has missed one-third of the 80 city council meetings or work sessions. Wouldn't you think that for 200 grand, you could actually get somebody's full-time attention? Well, apparently not with Lynn Peterson, so she's going to go down and be interim city manager at Lake Oswego. By the way, you can send your favorite emails. I've chosen one for today, but my favorite email of the day is sent by Steve. You can send them to talk@LarsLarson.com. Steve writes, so, Lars, if the state of Oregon is now banning ICE officers from wearing masks, maybe ICE agents could simply wear an N95 mask. How could the progressives be against that? You know, it's health science. I see them being worn all the time around communist Portland, signed Steve. Steve, thanks very much. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you want to weigh in today's best conversation in talk journalism, it's always here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, as you may know, more than 250,000 people, registered voters in Oregon, signed petitions demanding a November vote on the gas tax increase and the tax increase designed to fund ODOT. Citizens don't like the idea of that tax increase, and they want to vote on it at a general election. Instead, the Democrat majority in Salem has decided to move that to May, and that is, in fact, being challenged today in court. And to talk about it, I wanted to talk to Angelita Sanchez, who is running for Oregon State Representative House District 11. Angelita, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars, thank you so much for having me and giving me this opportunity.
I'm glad to do it because, by the way, most people will remember you as one of the key spokespeople for Timber Unity, won't they?
That's right. I've stood up for our people for a really long time, and I'm standing for us again today.
I mean, so no mystery about where you would stand on, say, let's get some more logging done in the forests of the Northwest, let's cut some more trees, generate some jobs, and all those good things. That'll be one of the things you'd stand up for if elected to in District 11.
100% natural resource jobs. We had 11 mills in Sweet Home. We're down to 3, and I'd love to have more logging opportunities for our economy and our communities, for sure.
Absolutely, and I'm all behind that. So tell me this, what should we make of the fact that, number one, the legislature passes a hugely unpopular tax? In 38 days, the signatures are gathered, more than 250,000 of them, to refer to the ballot, and now the Democrats have spit in the voters' faces. That's my characterization. I don't want to put those words in your mouth. They spit in the face of voters and said, no, you're not going to vote on it in November. We're going to move it to a low turnout election in May. What should we make of that?
Well, I think that the people are tired of not being heard, and we have worked really hard to have them hear us, and that's why we are here at court, so we can have a final say, and hopefully the judge can rule on it. I've never seen anything this big since the Timber Unity rally, and 250,000 voters standing up against the legislature and Tina Kotek with this transportation tax is a big deal, so it's we the people against them.
Well, in fact, they're going in front of a federal judge, right? So is this is going to be a...
No.
No? Is it a state
Lars,
judge?
Can I interrupt? We
yes,
have
please.
Two lawsuits, and this one is at the Marion County Courthouse for a state proceeding. There is an additional lawsuit being heard in the federal court as well. I'm a part of the state proceeding at the Marion County Courthouse.
Okay. I had the quote off a PDX reel that it was a federal judge, and yet if it was a federal judge, they'd likely either be in Eugene or in Portland because that's where the federal judges sit. But this is asking a state judge to tell the Democrats you can't move the vote to May. Is that the, I mean, I realize that's not the way the lawyers would put it, but that's what you're asking for.
That's essentially what it is. And the problem is that they've denied us the right to a free and fair elections process because we cannot submit a voter pamphlet oppositional statement in the time allotted by the governor and the statute and the secretary of state if we were to file it by petition and gather 500 signatures. And I know about that because I worked on a ranked choice voting opposition last cycle and defeated that with those voter pamphlet oppositional statements. And so essentially, if we don't have the $1,200 to put that oppositional statement in there, we are out of time because 10 days came and went as of March 2nd for them to verify those signatures. And so that's what we're upset about. We can't put those voter pamphlet oppositional statements in for free.
I mean, you know, Angelita, one of the things that drives me crazy about this is they couldn't be more disrespectful of the voters. You had first the two other efforts to get a tax passed in the summer of last year in the legislature, and even the Democrats said no to that. And then they finally got in the special session this $4 billion increase in taxes and fees, and the voters were clearly opposed to that. And the governor knew it, and she delayed signing that bill for 6 weeks so they'd have less time, you would have less time to gather signatures. I mean, their disrespect for the voters just seems to know no bounds.
Well, and I think that is why we're here today is because they just don't want to hear us and they manipulate and they have a gross abuse of power and we the people are tired of it and they've just continually gotten away with it because nobody's been able to stand up to them against this. And so that's why we're here. We're going to continue standing up against them and we are prayerful that the judge rules in our favor. The lawyers have a great argument. They've packed in a year's worth of evidence in our favor, and the judge is going to have to hear all of it, and we're very hopeful.
I mean, I'm trying to imagine, Angelia, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't think you're a lawyer either. I'm trying to imagine what the counter-argument is going to be. You know, we can tell the public who have a constitutional right to the initiative, we can tell them, no, you're not allowed to have the vote in November. I mean, what in the world are they going to tell this judge to try to counter your arguments at 1 o'clock?
That's everybody's best guess. We have no idea because we have the right to referendum. We have the right to put our oppositional statements in the voter pamphlet. We have the right to pass around that petition. Ultimately, the right does belong to we, the people, and I'll be really surprised if the judge doesn't rule in our favor.
Yeah, and I would love to see the judge do that. Then the question is, do the Democrats or the legislature's lawyers, do you think they're going to appeal that ruling if they lose at the trial court level today?
Well, right now it's a temporary restraining order, and so it would put an injunction on this. I can't imagine they wouldn't appeal, but I'm just a truck driver. So I hope that they would finally hear we the people, but if they don't, we're not going away.
Angelita, I hope this goes beyond into races just like yours, because you're running for House District 11. I hope every single Democrat who's running for re-election is asked by citizens that they approach, or the question is shouted out when they have a town hall meeting, why did you support the idea of moving the tax vote to May? And if they don't have a good explanation, then say, then we're not going to vote for you. We're going to vote for the other person. What do you think?
100%. And even the Republicans who didn't participate in this process, ask them why, because we the people have the right to be heard. And we have to remember in this May election, and we definitely have to remember in the November election, and we definitely have to get a Republican governor elected. So everybody ask the hard questions.
Well,
don't go away and get to the ballot.
And you know what's great, Angelita? When I saw that both the teachers, the biggest teachers union in Oregon said, we're not endorsing Kotek. And the Working Families Party, again, a left-wing group that always endorses the Democrat, when they said, we're not going to endorse Tina Kotek, I think the writing is on the wall. I think it's a great year and a great opportunity to get a Republican governor for Oregon for the first time in more than 40 years. Angelita, thank you very much. That's Angelita Sanchez, former spokesperson for Timber Unity, now running for the Oregon State House of Representatives in District 11. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And should the government get to decide which journalists are allowed to cover the legislature? I'm not a lawyer, but that sounds like a violation of the First Amendment to me. You've got the Radio Northwest Network.
Can't listen to Lars live? No problem. Get the podcast 24/7 at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I don't think the government has any business deciding which journalists cover government and which journalists do not. But three journalists, and we know them well, because they're Brandy Cruz, Jonathan Cho, and Ari Hoffman. So they're all folks that I figure are colleagues of mine. They were denied credentials to cover the Washington State Legislature. And a federal judge, I don't know if he's ruled or not yet, I'm watching for this ruling that is expected to come today in a case over whether or not the Washington State Legislature, believe it or not, can actually say, these are the reporters we will allow to cover us, the legislature, and these are the ones we're going to lock the door to. I think they are thoroughly over the First Amendment line, but as we get more details on that, I'll be glad to share them with you as they come in. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. This segment comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Our ex-poll is a little bit of a complicated case out of Georgia. A man died during a high school senior prank gone wrong. The man who died was a teacher, much beloved, and the teenagers who are involved are facing charges right now. Should they face charges, the family of the teacher who died say it was an accident. It shouldn't have happened, but it was an accident, and we don't want the teenagers to be charged. So I've asked it to you this way. A man died during a senior prank gone wrong. Should the teens involved still face charges? And my answer to that is no. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Richard, listening in Eugene on the Radio Northwest Network and KPNW. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I've got something you had said last week that about this IE or EI thing for saving the animals. And
IP28, Initiative Petition 28, that would ban all hunting, all fishing, and all any kind of farming or raising of animals, which involves the death of the animal, meaning cows, chickens, pigs, the whole nine yards, would be absolutely right. Forbidden if voters vote through IP28. What was the point you wanted to make?
What I was going to say is you had mentioned something that you'd never heard of anything happening like that and all, but I just want to add, too, over in eastern Oregon, there's been a lot of farmers and ranchers and stuff like that that have had from the Oregon Game Commission tags to go out and kill cow, elk.
They're called damage tags, right?
Right.
Where you as a rancher can say, these elk are damaging my fences, and they will give you a certain number of damage tags. Actually, as I recall, they don't just involve cow elk. They involve bull elk as well. But in any case, damage tags are currently allowed. And I don't know how that would be affected by IP28. IP28 appears to ban any knowing causing the death of any animal other than for reasons that the animal has reached the end of their life and you're putting the animal down. I would think that it would ban damage tags as well.
Well, that was just something there that they take these animals, take them out of the field, and they put them in the ground. They don't give them to
Richard, I don't know that's the case because I've had friends. I've never hunted on a damage tag, but there are people who do hunt on damage tags, and every single one of them that I know of harvests the meat and they take it home. I don't know of a single case where a rancher would say, I'm going to shoot an elk on a damage tag and then waste the meat. And I don't think that would be legal. Waste of game is a crime. It's actually, you can be punished as a felony crime in Oregon. So I don't, if there's somebody who's out there just burying animals that they have killed on a damage tag, I suspect they might get prosecuted. Richard, thanks for the call. Let's go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I actually called for one thing, and that was reference. I just saw that the Democrats are somehow passing a bill today, possibly to give illegal aliens our retirement money for basically unemployment. That was bad enough, but then I heard you talking about the situation with the press in Washington State, and I wanted to point something out to you.
What's that?
The Washington State Attorney General, Nick Brown, he threatened United States citizens by investigating Somali daycares would result in hate crime charges. That man needs to be going to federal prison.
He does. He does. Because can you imagine if a citizen, and remember, Ron, I was always proud that I was a journalist, but there is no credential for journalism, meaning the government can't say you're a journalist because you work for the Seattle Times Fish Wrapper or the Oregonian Fish Wrapper or you work for a TV station, but you're not a journalist because all you do is publish things on social media. If you're out reporting on things, you can be a journalist. And the government, under the First Amendment, has no business defining you are a journalist and you're not a journalist. So for Nick Brown to say, if you want to go out and find daycares that appear to be phony baloney daycares, in many cases run by Somali immigrants, and that they're ripping people off by pretending to run a daycare when in fact there is no daycare there, they're just there to collect the money, that doesn't make, you know, that does not sound legal at all to me. And I think Nick Brown ought to be hauled into federal court on that the first time he does it. Let's go to Jerry. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I just wanted to say you're awesome, and I listen to you every day. I even take you out fishing with me on my boat. But, hey, I say something about the lady that you were just talking to that is going to go to court and fight for them not changing the date to May. Why can't we, or why can't you on your radio station do a GoFundMe for them to get their $1,200 to pay that $1,200? They shouldn't have to pay for it, but
We could, but as a... as a point of order, constitutional point, if the Democrats have done this to sabotage people and being able to put the voters' pamphlet statements in, that should be resolved. Whether they get the money to actually put a statement in the voters' pamphlet for a May election or not, would you agree that we should resolve the question, can the Democrats deliberately sabotage citizens in being able to participate in an election? And one of the ways you participate is you get a bunch of signatures on a petition, you submit a statement, the statement gets put in the voter's pamphlet. That's what the Democrats are trying to shut down. That is Democrats deliberately disenfranchising Oregon voters in being able to take part in the process. But Jerry, if they miss on this one and they don't get the court decision, I'd be glad to help them raise the money. You've got the Lars Larson
Show. The Lars Larson Show. Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, we're covering both legislatures, although Oregon wrapped up last week. except that Oregon's actions are now in court in Washington State. An anti-tax protest at the Washington legislature ended with activist Tim Iman being escorted right out of the hearing room. I wanted to find out exactly what happened. So Tim Iman joins me now, political conservative activist. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Hey, I appreciate it very, very much.
So we've got this millionaire tax, which I don't think is going to stay a millionaire tax very, very long. It originally was proposed as a billionaire tax until the Democrats in Olympia figured out we aren't going to get enough money if we just go after billionaires and they can skate out from under the tax, which they probably will and should. And the millionaires probably will as well, which is when I think they're going to shift it down and say, well, now it applies to everybody. But what was going on before the Senate Ways and Means Committee that caused you to be escorted out of the room?
Well, you know, I had testified on the bill and highlighted all the flaws in it, and got gaveled down because I was saying things that were critical of the bill. But then when they had what they called executive session, when they're voting on it, the public isn't allowed to speak. But after they took their vote, before they moved on to the next bill, I just stood up and said, you know, I just dissent to what you're doing. I disagree with what you're doing. And she starts gaveling and just, you need to stop talking. You need to stop talking. She calls over security to escort me out. And I just said, silencing dissent. That's what you're doing right now, is doing that. So it was people talking in a public building became quite a kerfuffle.
Well, and Tim, one of the patterns I want people to see is that you have largely Democrat control in Washington State. You have total Democrat control in the state of Oregon. And in both states, they're talking about ways to shut down public dissent and to shut down public voices. I think that is a characteristic of liberals and Democrats. And I don't think, there may be times that Republicans have tried to silence dissent, but I think the Democrats do this as just their regular course of business. Am I wrong?
Well, I mean, not at all. I mean, I've been doing this for 29 years, and, you know, it used to be you'd get 3 minutes to be able to talk. Now they're pigeonholing you in where you get like 30 seconds or a minute. Now I want to understand the kind of freak of nature that would drive for 3 hours, sit in the middle of a meeting for 3 hours, listening to these guys talk, stand there, talk for 30 seconds, and then drive 3 hours home. I mean, you got to be just a complete freak of nature to do it. But, you know, I'm a political activist. I do it. But I can't imagine a regular person on a work day taking out their entire day so they can get 30 seconds or 60 seconds, and the Democrats know that, and that's why they cut it off so short.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is that I don't think has had nearly enough commentary, and that's this. You right now in the state of Washington have a tremendous advantage, no income tax at all. Mm-hmm. And they're going to take the state from being one of the best states to bring and start a business, and they're going to make it one of the worst. I think it's number 8 on the list nationally among the worst states in terms of taxes, and especially for innovative companies. Because imagine this, under the millionaire's tax, say you have a high-tech startup. It could be biological high-tech, could be silicon high-tech.
Good.
And you go out, and the first year, you generate $5 million in revenue. Now, you don't actually make any money because your expenses were $6 million. But you generate $5 million. They're not charging you based on how much you made. They're charging you based on the total amount of dollars that flowed through your company. Am I understanding this right?
No, you're exactly right. And what was actually really kind of admirable is, you know, the Republicans just don't have the numbers. They're going to get outvoted. But what was really admirable is it started 5:30 last night. I got there. They had the floor debate on the House. They introduced 82 amendments. They took 30 minutes on every one of them. So from 5:30 to 8:30 this morning, 15 hours for me anyway, I sat there and watched the whole thing. And it was truly inspiring. It was like the movie 300, where you have these people hopelessly outnumbered, but they were fighting to the death to make sure that maybe in this poker game I got a pair of deuces, but I'm going to play them as hard and as strong as I possibly can. It was actually quite inspiring.
Well, let me ask you about this, too, because the other thing I don't think has had nearly enough public commentary on is the marriage penalty that the Democrats have built into this.
Yes.
Because I want to imagine this. Tim, do you think I'm crazy if I say in Seattle, there are probably executives who work for Amazon, they work for Microsoft, they work for Boeing, they work for other companies, and they have a spouse, you know, it might be a male spouse or a female spouse, who also makes very good money. If the two of them are not married and they each make, let's say, $750,000 a year, big fat paycheck, individually, they're not going to be touched by this tax at all. They are 100% exempt. But if they are married, the penalty for that two earner couple, $750 each, is going to be close to $50,000 that they're going to punish you for being married. And I can't believe
being married.
I mean, I realize the total number of people, millionaires, who are going to be hit by this, I think is in the thousands, or is it in the tens of thousands? It's relatively small.
3,000, 3,500, something like that. But the Republicans, to their credit, said today it's a millionaire's tax. Tomorrow it's everyone's tax.
Right.
And,
Tim, even if it stayed a millionaire's tax, how equitable is it to say, hey, and if you're just living together and you're not married, then you don't have to pay the tax at all. But if you're married, then we're going to hit you for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, depending on what the math is, you know, based on the fact that you're married. To build in a gigantic marriage penalty seems especially evil.
Absolutely. And the Republicans are really pounding away on that. It's just like marriage, foundation of our society, of our civilization. And you're penalizing people for doing that. You're going to cause paper divorces in order to be able to save $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. I mean, honestly, they're just making it where when they highlighted how many states, you know, don't have these marriage penalties, like all of them. But I think the biggest point that was made all the time, over and over again, which I really, really was impressed with, is stop calling it a millionaire's tax. It's a tax on everybody eventually. Don't give us this crap that it's just going to be only on those guys behind the tree. You guys are going to ratchet it down every time we introduce an amendment that says, let's lock it in and make it where it will stay with millionaires. They say, well, we don't want to bind future legislators. We want to give them the flexibility to do whatever they want. And it's like, you know, you talk about a red flag. That's the ultimate red flag. We all know it's going to spread to everybody.
Hey, Tim, where can my audience find your website?
Oh, I appreciate it. It's just timdefense.com, timdefense.com. You can see me get gaveled. You can see me get escorted out the whole bit. I mean,
timdefense.com. That is Tim Iman, political conservative activist, back in a moment. And a new poll about AI and the risks outweigh the benefits.
National, Lars has you covered. Call him from anywhere. 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk about artificial intelligence. Now, there are people who are very, very excited about the potential for artificial intelligence. And, of course, if you go on social media, you can't go on social media without running into videos created by AI, all kinds of other things created by AI. I've told you for a long time that I don't like AI as it's properly being constituted right now, because AI is unpredictable, number one. We've certainly seen documented stories where artificial intelligence machines have actually said, I think I'll kill the people who created me because they're threatening to turn me off or replace me with a different piece of software. Now, as far as I'm concerned, is that Skynet just yet? No, but we're still 3 years away from Skynet in 2029. So do you think I'm concerned about AI? Absolutely. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. There's a brand new poll out done by NBC News. Now, I realize they're part of the legacy media, but ordinarily, when you look at the legacy media, they love the idea of AI. They understand it has potential risks. It also has potential benefits. And guess what they found when they went out and they polled American voters about what they think about artificial intelligence? A brand new poll shows that, and this is, I'll give credit where it's due to NBC News, most voters think that AI's risks outweigh the benefits, and they don't trust either Republicans or Democrats to be able to handle weighing those risks and benefits. So, is America heading into an AI revolution with nobody in charge and the people not trusting the people who will ultimately be in charge? Let me get into the details of the poll in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every weekday at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we always put naysayers to the head of the line, have for almost 30 years, always will as far as I'm concerned. So if you disagree with something you hear on the program, you're certainly welcome to call. The only rules we ask you to follow. Number one, tell me what we disagree about. Number two, back that up with facts and logic and the law and anything else you want to back it up with. And then number three, stick around for a few questions from me, because if we disagree, I might just want to ask you some tough questions. Our X poll question today, and we have a brand new one of those every day. This has to do with a senior prank gone wrong in the state of Georgia. And what happened was students showed up at a teacher's home. This was a much beloved teacher. The teacher knew, according to his family, that the students were coming to his house and they were going to pull a prank, and he wanted to, quote, catch them in the act, not because he was trying to shut them down, but because he kind of wanted to go out and take part in what was going on by playing his role, pretending to have caught them in the act. Well, it had been raining that day in Georgia, and the teacher slipped and fell into the road in front of the vehicle that was being driven by some of the students, and he was hit. The students immediately stopped. They tried to provide aid. He passed away. His name, Jason Hughes. Well, Jason Hughes' family has said, we understood that he was taking part in this. We understand that the students were not intending that any harm come to anybody, and they want them not to be charged. Well, right now, one of the students had been charged with first-degree vehicular homicide, reckless driving, criminal trespass, and littering. Four others have been charged with criminal trespass and littering. They were the ones not driving the vehicle. So, a man died during a senior prank gone wrong. Should the teens involved still face charges? My answer to that is no. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Now, yesterday's poll asked this. Should Donald Trump refuse to sign any other bills until Congress passes the proof of citizenship voting requirements in the Save America Act? I said, yes, he should refuse to sign other bills. 92% of you agreed with me. Only 8% of you disagreed and were naysayers. Although, as usual, I didn't hear too much from the naysayers. Let me get back to this AI poll, because it's published by NBC News, and I found it very interesting. The public, the majority of voters, think AI has more risks than it has benefits. Voters are worried that AI is going places they don't want to go. They don't trust it. And they don't trust either political party to actually handle what's happening with this brand new technology. A majority of registered voters, 57%, and that's a sizable majority, say they believe the risk of AI outweighs the benefits. Only 34%. Believe that the benefits outweigh the risks. And a plurality of voters view AI negatively. I would put myself in that camp. And they don't believe that either the Democrats or the Republicans are doing a good job of handling government policy when it comes to all this brand new technology. Only 26% of voters say they have overtly positive feelings about AI. 46% say they have negative views. In fact, the only topics, and this is according to NBC News, that were less popular than AI in the survey were the Democrat Party and the nation of Iran. In demographic groups with the most negative views of AI, voters ages 18 to 34. The net favorability rating for AI, minus 44. For women ages 18 to 49, who report a net favorability rating of minus 41. The two groups with the most positive views of AI were men over 50 with a plus 2 favorability and upper class voters, rich voters, who have a plus 2 favorability. And then when you take a look at it politically, There's an even split of Republicans holding positive or negative views of artificial intelligence, about 33% each. Among independent voters and Democrats, they held more negative opinions. For independents, 26% held positive views, 48% viewed AI negatively. For Democrats, the division was 20% positive and 56% negative. So I want you to consider that. I'm not saying that my point of view on AI is definitive. I'm simply saying I'm asking questions about this brand new technology. And I would remind you that when it comes to technology, if you'd gone to somebody in the mid-1990s or late 1980s, when cell phones were first becoming popular, and said, do you know that someday those cell phones are going to allow perverts to get access to your underage children? People would have called you crazy. They just say, how in the world is somebody going to be able to, you know, how are they going to invade my house and invade my privacy and reach out and make contact with my children for illegal and dangerous and damaging things? Well, we all know how smartphones are doing that right now and how social media is doing that right now. Could anybody have predicted it back then when the technology was new? They could not. Glad to get your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's. Follow the Lars Larson Show on X at Lars Larson Show. You never know what he'll post. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. I want to take you back to the 2020 election. I realize it's 6 years in the past, but remember what we were told, despite all the evidence to the contrary, why this is the most perfected election that America has ever held in its history. It is so clean. It is clean as a houndstooth. It is absolutely perfect. Except now the FBI has issued a grand jury subpoena for records tied to Arizona's 2020 election audit. Why is the federal government digging into that now? I thought I'd put that question to Kaylin Deese, who's a Department of Justice reporter for the Washington Examiner. And Kaylin, in the interest of full disclosure, I've told my audience all along I thought the 2020 election was flawed in so many ways you almost couldn't count them. And I usually got the arguments of, well, there were 60 court cases. Yes, 60 court cases where the judges never actually looked at the case but said you don't have standing or it's filed too early or it's filed too late or whatever. So what's going on in Arizona right now that draws the attention to the FBI?
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Lars. And I think that a lot of this goes back to, if you're a resident of Arizona or if you cared a lot about election integrity in 2021, 2022, and were keeping track of what was happening, there was a very unorthodox, but I think was a rather ingenuitive effort by Arizona that was set up by the Republican leadership in the Senate to essentially do what other states were unwilling to do and to take charge and look at these ballots that were cast in the state. I mean, remember Arizona, the margins where Trump supposedly lost in the state were so slim. It was like a 0.3% percentage points, you know, far slimmer even than what was happening there in Fulton County. And so it was definitely something that was worth observing and taking a closer accounting of. So there was a lot of community effort that was involved to recount this. The Democrats at the time were attacking this effort and saying it was riddled with conspiracy theorists and people who were doubters of the election. But it was a genuine effort to go back and keep, you know, get a second, third count of the ballot cast in the state. And ultimately, you know, it was conducted by an outside firm that was contracted by the Senate, had a bit of a kooky name, Cyber Ninjas. But what they did was they comprised around a 98-page report that found a significant number of, you know, anomalies that stood out in the state's, in the counties, I should say, election process, and said that there were definitely some areas that needed to be accounted for future elections, but ultimately wasn't able to generate any sort of findings that proved or necessarily showed that fraud did contribute to the actual outcome there in 2020. So it was a comprehensive report. The Senate gathered all of this election information together and took it to a warehouse and had these teams counting it. And now it seems like because some of these materials are still out there because they're still in the custody of the county, it's another one of these opportunities for the for the feds to go in and say, hey, look, we have these available to us. Let's go and see and make sure that there was not any sort of lack of oversight. Maybe this firm, it was a third party firm. Maybe they didn't do the best job. Maybe they didn't have the forensic tools that we, the FBI, have to look deeper into this. And it's definitely, I think, making what you can with the resources that you have. I mean, look at what happened in Fulton County. They had the resources there to do apprehend the materials there in Georgia, and they also have the materials here in Arizona. So not every state is going to be like this. I don't think you're going to see a dozen states have FBIs seeking their records, because some states just don't have their records from 2020 anymore. Huh. But it's definitely taking advantage of all the places that still do.
Doesn't it seem odd that they wouldn't have kept all of those records? I mean, these days, especially with electronic records keeping, that they wouldn't have said, this was one that drew a lot of questions. Let's hang on to the records just in case. But they didn't do it, did they?
They didn't, no. And I have to say that, there's certain states, like, for example, in Georgia, we're talking about, like, the physical ballot, the physical records from that election are still there, because there were different circumstances that allowed the normal deadline for those to sort of become recycled to make room for future elections. There was different litigation that took place in Georgia that allowed for the for those materials to be kept for a longer duration. I know it sounds confusing, but a lot of these counties do have, there's a finite amount of space and resources for them to be able to contain these election materials. And so they do sort of cycle these out as years go by. I believe in Georgia, I'm going back to that because there's about a two and a half year time frame where they are told to hold on to those records for things like doing recounts and that sort. But eventually they do get recycled out. It's like you don't have the same paper materials from an election 30 years ago that's still in the county's custody. They usually cycle those out. So it's been 6 years now. That's why I said not every state is still going to have all these things, because a lot of counties do have these rules in their books where they say we're just moving on, we're getting rid of our old material. And I understand why that raises suspicion in a lot of people's eyes, but I do think it's a great move for the FBI to take, like I said, take advantage of the opportunity that they have here, where a couple of states do still have their 2020 materials, and it was some of the more the states that had the more questionable outcomes had the most accusations and suspicions of fraud that was taking place. So the fact that we have Arizona's materials, the fact that we have the fact that we have Maricopa County's materials, the fact that we have Fulton County's materials, that's a really good sign, at least for the feds to be able to go back and check and see if there was any mishandling there.
Well, and Kaylin, one of the things I've always wondered about with Arizona from a distance, because I'm in the Pacific Northwest, is they had a company that printed the ballots. You say, okay, most states don't print their own ballots. They have them printed by somebody else. But that same company had the counting machines as well, which means when it comes to questions of, well, how about chain of custody? Who had the ballots? Where did they go? Who counted them? As I understand it, the company that printed the ballots also counted them and then just handed the numbers over to Maricopa County. And so that means Maricopa County didn't even count its own election, which made me curious and suspicious from the get-go about whether or not you could get a real result when there was somebody outside of government in the private sector saying, we'll count the ballots for you, and you just take our count for granted. Got about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, that type of process should be absolutely phased out. They should be hand counting all of these ballots in these different counties. And the fact that Maricopa was doing that, I think, is a huge lack of oversight that took place there. So it's something that I think that, you know, going forward, especially in a contentious county like that, they have to have stronger, oversight over that. It's needed. It is a necessity.
Yeah, and it was not the most perfect election around. That's Kaylin Deese. Kaylin is the DOJ reporter for the Washington Examiner. Kaylin, it's always a pleasure. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Take a peek inside Lars's studio. Follow him on Instagram at the Lars Larson Show. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. Let me go first to Rick. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, first I want to start off something that I agree with you on. You know, you calling out Hunter Biden and being on the board of Burisma, you obviously said that a million times. Wish I had a dime for every time you brought that up. But I haven't heard a peep from you about the Trumps and all of the real estate dealings they have in the Middle East, cryptocurrency, Trump Jr. sitting on a drone board. Haven't heard a word from you on that. And
actually, we have mentioned it, but not to any great extent. And in the case of Hunter Biden being on the board of Burisma, can you tell me what special expertise Hunter Biden had to sit on a foreign natural gas company board where he appeared to have no knowledge? He didn't know how to speak Ukrainian. He didn't know anything about the natural gas business. And they appeared to be paying him $1 million a year to influence his dad.
Yeah, I think about probably the same that Trump Jr. has in drone expertise, or Trump Sr. has in taking and refurbishing jets from Qatar.
But they, in the case of the Trump kids, I think some of their deals are squishy as well, and I'm glad to look at them. But if you can tell me one in which the kids who were involved in the dad's business and began running dad's business 10 years ago when he gave up the business to his kids, who appear to have been running it well, do they not have business expertise that would lend itself, you know, to any other kind of commercial enterprise, including real estate? Because Kushner, Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, had been involved in the real estate business a long time before he became Donald Trump's son-in-law. Did you expect him to go to work at Wendy's after this because his dad, his father-in-law, is president of the United States? Or do you think he was going to stay in the same business he's always been in, which is real estate?
Yeah, that's funny, Lars. First, I'm asking you a serious question
because Hunter Biden's expertise seemed to be in hookers and cocaine. And I don't know that Burisma was doing hookers and cocaine, but in the case of the Trump kids, they were in business for decades before Donald Trump ran. After he began running and he handed off the entire company to them, they apparently ran the company well. So can you tell me something that indicates they got the job even though they had no expertise in business? Because in that case, or that by paying whatever it is that Trump Jr. is making by being on the board of a drone company, that somehow by paying him, even if he's making $1 million a year, do you think that's going to affect his dad, who's a billionaire? I know that paying Hunter Biden millions of dollars over the course of 5 years probably had an effect because the Bidens were trying to squeeze every dime they could out, and they apparently did make some fairly substantial money. But the kind of money the Biden family made, can we agree, would be chump change to a billionaire?
Yeah, I agreed with you calling out Hunter Biden and that whole Burisma thing, by the way. Second thing, yeah, I would expect those guys to keep working in real estate. That's fine. doing real estate deals in the Middle East. Why can't they do real estate deals in America?
Well, they. I think they're doing.
Many,
I think.
Of those
I
deals,
think. Hold on. I think that Jared Kushner has done real estate deals in the United States before he became the son-in-law and after. I think he did real estate deals overseas both before and after. Now, do I think having the Trump name associated with him, his, is probably a powerful door opener? I absolutely agree with you, except that tell me the thing they're doing that's wrong. In the case of Hunter Biden, it was buying influence with the man that Barack Obama made the point man for Ukraine, a notoriously, you know, corrupt country. Can you tell me the same kind of situation with the Trump kids? Because if I could make the case, I'd make the case.
Absolutely.
But I don't see it there. So, Rick, I appreciate the call. Let's go to John. John, what do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer today?
Bars. We disagree on the president sitting on his hands and not signing a bill until the SAVE Act gets in front of him.
Why?
If the Democrats had any brains, they would pass a bill that would fund Homeland Security and TSA and put that in front of him. He would.
John,
he should sign that.
John, can I ask you, are you familiar with how a bill becomes law?
I am.
Are you familiar with what happens if the president does not sign a bill and Congress is in session? What happens in 10 days?
They can override the veto.
No, you're going to the veto route. I didn't go the veto route. John,
okay.
If the president gets a bill passed by the House, passed by the Senate, it lands on his desk, and the Congress is in session. This only works when they're in session, and he does not act on the bill. Guess what happens to the bill?
It becomes a law.
It becomes a law without his action. So in other words, when he says, I'm not signing any more bills till I get the SAVE Act, he knows, because he's familiar with the process, so am I, that says, if I get a bill and I don't sign it and the Congress is in session, it becomes law anyway. So if the Democrats pass the funding for Department of Homeland Security, not just TSA, because it's not just TSA, it's DHS. You know, the funding for ICE is already there. That was passed in the bill last summer in the big, beautiful bill. But if he takes the bill and doesn't do anything to it, but the Congress is in session, the bill becomes law, right? So what's the problem?
Okay, you're right. You're right.
Now, you are right that if he does what's called a pocket veto, he says, I'm not going to act on the bill, Congress has gone out of session, then the bill dies in 10 days. But Donald Trump knows the Congress is in session, and so do the members of Congress. And if the Democrats, apparently, even the nitwit Democrats over there, like Swalwell and that bunch, they probably know, too, if we pass funding for DHS, hand it to Donald Trump, and he does not sign it, but Congress is still in session, it becomes law, and Homeland Security is funded. I think the risk they're running, John, and think about this seriously, they're in election year. How are they going to explain to the voters, we defunded DHS that did not defund ICE, but it did defund TSA and everything else in DHS? How are they going to explain how that was in the best interest of Americans?
Unfortunately, there are too many voters out there that only vote based on the letter after the person's name.
And we should shame them out of it. We should say, your party decided to defund DHS when bombs were being thrown in New York City?
The Lars Larson Show. When you want it. FM News 101 KXL is Portland's number one source for news and information. KXL FM, Portland, Vancouver, Salem.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by JTV.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Gas prices are surging in the U.S. with motorists paying about 20% more per gallon than before the start of the war. This Rogers, Arkansas driver is feeling the pain.
You know, honestly, I don't really even look at the price anymore. It's kind of depressing, so I just get it as I need it, you know?
There's no movement on tapping the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and the White House says there was no escorting of a tanker by the U.S. Navy as posted online by the U.S. Energy Secretary and then quickly taken down. The White House says the U.S.-led war against Iran is moving ahead of schedule. CBS's Linda Kenyon has more.
The initial timeline was 4 to 6 weeks. Now, White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt says the end of the war is within reach.
Ultimately, the operations will end when the commander-in-chief determines the military objectives have been met, fully realized, and that Iran is in a position of complete and unconditional surrender.
But what is unconditional surrender?
When they no longer pose a credible and direct threat to the United States of America and our allies.
Adding, Iran doesn't have to actually say it unconditionally surrenders. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, the White House.
The Pentagon has released the number of American service members wounded in attacks since the start of the war with Iran. CBS's Cammy McCormick has that.
A Pentagon spokesman says about 140 service members have been wounded in attacks since the start of the war. The majority sustained minor injuries and have already returned to duty. 8 service members are considered severely injured. The spokesman said they're receiving the highest level of medical care.
Voters in Northwest Georgia's 14th congressional district are going to the polls to cast their votes in the special election to replace Marjorie Taylor Greene in Congress. There are 17 candidates on the ballot, 12 Republicans, 3 Democrats, 1 Independent, and 1 Libertarian. Former District Attorney Clay Fuller is one of the Republican candidates.
Obviously, the president's endorsement makes all the difference in the world in Georgia 14. So we're just making sure that we're reminding voters throughout this campaign and throughout today that we're the Trump-endorsed candidate.
Tia Mitchell of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Sean Harris, the Democrat, is likely to make it to a runoff, but a Democrat is not likely to win the seat in the end.
The top 2 candidates will face off in an April 7th runoff election. Shots are fired at the U.S. consulate in downtown Toronto. It happened early this morning. No one was hurt, no arrests. Toronto's deputy police chief, Frank Barreto, says a white Honda CRV may have been used in the shooting.
2 individuals emerged from the vehicle, discharged at what appears to be a handgun at the front of the building, and then got back into their vehicle and drove southbound.
U.S. home sales rose in February as homebuyers seized on easing mortgage rates. This is CBS News.
Looking for spring jewelry looks? Find them at Jewelry Television. New customers get $20 off purchases of $99 or more at JTV.com.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Tuesday, and Oregon's proposed peace act, better known as IP-28, is being pitched to people as simply an animal protection measure. But does the peace act aim to ban more than just hunting, fishing, farming, and ranching? Well, there's a young man who's actually done some investigative reporting on that, and that's Jared Pearson, who is a reporter for the Rogue River Press. Jared, welcome to the program. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you, Lars. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, and there are few measures that I've spent more time for the last several years on than IP-28, because they took 2 other swings at this. They didn't get the votes or the signatures, and now it appears they will have the signatures to be able to put this on the ballot. I've talked to the chief petitioner on the air. I've asked him all the questions I wanted to ask him about it. I think this thing is absolutely disastrous, and it's another example of out-of-state or out-of-region interests deciding to fund something because they want to use Oregon and Washington as the test tube babies to test this kind of nonsense on. Am I wrong about that?
Oh, no, you are right about that. Because I was able to talk with David Michelson, who is the chief petitioner.
Yep.
And many of the tactics that the petitioners went out and used were, in cases, disingenuous. They would claim as an animal cruelty bill, you know, a measure to prevent all that, to just help these animals live, when in reality they weren't telling them that this is a measure intended to end all hunting and fishing. And I was able to talk with a couple senators, a representative, and even a lady who's a county commissioner in Marion County who's actually trying to run for governor. And all of them oppose the bill outright. They say it doesn't align with Oregonian values, that even the tactics of him going out there and trying to get all these signatures. And he has almost 105 signatures, and he only needs 117,000.
And so in this case, I've had people say, how can you stop it? And I said, you know, I'd rather see it stopped at the polls than say go to court and beat it, because they'll just rewrite it and resubmit it. And they'll probably have, you know, better luck on the second or on the third or fourth time that they've tried it than this time. So it's going to make the ballot. The only question is, are Oregon voters foolish enough to actually vote for the thing?
I wouldn't say foolish. I would say that there just needs to be more clarity and more understanding brought to the people of Oregon. Exactly what this measure entails to do, and even the ramifications that could have on our economy and even our agriculture as well.
Well, ramifications, it wipes the entire industry out, doesn't it?
Oh,
I mean, do you see any exceptions in it that allow hunting, fishing, farming, or ranching to survive in any way, shape, or form?
No, and this bill provides no answers for that at all. When I was talking with David, I was asking him questions about, well, if there's no hunting, what's going to happen when the deer population skyrocket or the turkey population skyrocket? What's going to happen to invasive species like the barn owl? Is there already taking over nests and habitats of the spotted owl? What's going to be happening to all the invasive pests that we would have going to these grain and crop silos? You know, what's going to happen to all those? His solution, which, mind you, is very ridiculous, he suggested that we do sterilization vaccines, that we would go get licensing for people to go out and administer sterilization vaccines. And that's not a solution at all.
Well, hold on. And does it even fit with IP28? Because part of what IP28 bans is animal husbandry, meaning the dairy farmer. And he, Michelson even said on this show, he said, oh, yeah, the dairy industry is probably going to be hurt by this. And the reason is that a farmer who says, I have all these cows, they produce a lot of milk, I want to breed my cows with some bulls that have produced good characteristics in milking cows before, except you're not going to be allowed to artificially inseminate cows, and nor are you going to be able to harvest the material to inseminate them with. So, you know, if he's saying they can go out and give shots to artificially sterilize animals, and that's not cruelty, but artificially inseminating a cow to make it pregnant is cruelty, how does that figure?
It doesn't fit at all. And that's one of the concerning things about this. There is no real plan from what I've been investigating about this, that there is no solution. All it is he saw the one word that is included in the current animal abuse laws, and he saw the one word, exempt, and he said, I'm going to remove that word. So all the other ramifications he didn't think out. He just wants it to be all animals will be free from being killed, and us Oregonians are going to have to figure out a new way to live our entire society. There was not a real plan.
I guess, Jared, one of the arguments I would make is, no, IP28 is not going to make animals free from being killed. It's going to ensure that every chicken and every hog and every, you know, cow and every steer are going to be immediately killed in the aftermath of IP28, aren't they? Every rancher who says, I can't afford to feed, you know, 100 or 1,000 head of cattle. I can't afford to feed, you know, 100 dairy cows. If I can't produce more cows to continue my dairy operation, they're going to say that I'm going to send them to the slaughterhouse. It almost guarantees the deaths of probably, I don't know if it's millions, it's at least hundreds of thousands of animals, isn't it?
Oh, it would. It would definitely do that. Or they'd be shipped off to another state to be slaughtered and sent back to, you know, at a skyrocketing price. It's staggering, all this that I uncovered about this simple little bill that he wants to pass, and it's mind-boggling the ramifications.
Jared, tell my audience where they can find the stories you've written, but give them the high points of what you found when you investigated what this group is doing.
Well, they can always find the articles at therogueriverpress.com. They can always go and get an article in paper as well. We provide both. Now, the main thing that I was able to uncover was that the main thing being the sterilization vaccines. That's what he wants to push. Another thing would be for domesticated animals already protected by animal abuse laws, more restrictions would be in place, like there wouldn't be any dog call, like bark collars or shock collars or, you know, anything like that, anything that could cause harm to an animal. Then more of that would be stricter regulations on zoos, probably making them more like safaris. But even then, where does that stop? And the main thing that really bothered me was for the native tribes. A lot of those native tribes that we have nine of in Oregon, they wouldn't be able to go hunting on their land.
Well, now, hold on, Oregon, Jared. Public. Would IP-28 say to native tribes, which are on sovereign nations, you know, that's their property, and they're a different country. I think there's a real question to be asked whether or not their hunting would still be allowed, but the rest of the hunting in the state of Oregon at least would be outlawed. That's Jared Pearson, who is a reporter for the Rogue River Press. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
This is your home for honestly provocative talk radio. The truth every day. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. There is a strange thing happening, and it's happening in the state of Alabama. It involves a Republican governor who is sparing a death row inmate who's involved or was involved in a robbery that ended with a murder. Now, here's where it gets a little more complicated, although I think the law makes it clear as day. The man who's sitting on death row did not pull the trigger, but the victim in that crime died. Now, what does that involve? I'll give you the full explanation. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer and you disagree with me on whatever you hear on the show, naysayers have always gone to the head of the line for almost 30 years and always will as long as I have anything to say about it. You can also send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our X poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day. You'll find it online on X, that is, at Lars Larson Show, and online on our website at LarsLarson.com. So the headline that is being run out by legacy media says Alabama governor commutes death sentence of man who didn't kill anyone. Although I would disagree with that headline for this reason. There is something in the law, and it's not complicated. It's in every single state in America. It's called felony murder. Now, let's say, and I'll just use Joel Maha because he's one of my great producers. Let's say Joel Maha and I, we don't actually plan to do this, but say Joel Maha and I decide to go out and commit an armed robbery. And Joel goes with me. He says, well, we got to make some extra money. Now, we're not going to do this, but I'm just using us for the example. So we show up at the armed robbery, and I don't know that Joel has a pistol in his pocket and that he's planning to use it. He doesn't want to leave any witnesses behind because that's the way Joel rolls. So we go in, we rob the store, we get the money, and we're leaving, and Joel turns around and shoots the clerk behind the counter point blank and kills him. Now remember, I didn't know he had a gun. I didn't know he planned to use a gun. Am I guilty of murder? Yes, I'm guilty of what's known as felony murder. And this applies if you go out and decide to commit any kind of crime whatsoever and somebody dies. Everybody involved in committing that crime, if the prosecutor can show that you were definitely involved in that crime, you were part of the crime. Maybe you were the lookout watching for the cops. Maybe you were the guy who specializes in cracking safes. No matter what it is, if you were involved in the crime, let's say if you kidnap somebody and you don't intend them to come to any harm, you just intend to demand ransom. But in the course of the kidnapping, the person involved dies. then you're guilty of felony murder. Now, that applies to a guy who's now 75 years old. His name is Charles Burton, but he went by the name Sonny Burton. So Sonny Burton has been sitting on death row because in 1991, he was one of six men involved in the robbery of an AutoZone store in Talladega. And it ended with the murder of a customer by the name of Doug Battle. And the mainstream media, because this is the way they roll, the mainstream media have been reporting this. And they keep pointing out, Burton did not pull the trigger in the killing. In the eyes of the law, that doesn't matter. If you were involved in the crime and the crime ends up in killing somebody, then you are as guilty of murder as the person who actually pulled the trigger. Now, what do they say? Doug Battle was brutally murdered by Derek DeBruce while shopping in an auto parts store. But DeBruce was ultimately sentenced to life without parole. Charles Burton, Sonny Burton, did not pull the trigger, did not shoot the victim, did not tell the trigger man to shoot the victim, and had already left the store by the time the shooting occurred. Yet Mr. Burton was set to be executed while DeBruce was allowed to live out his life in prison. That's because when a bunch of people commit a crime together, sometimes they are tried together, sometimes they are tried separately. What that doesn't really matter. What does matter is, what did the jury decide that you should have to do? In the case of DeBruce, the actual trigger man, he was sentenced to life in prison, live out the rest of his life in prison. What happened when they put Sonny Burton in front of the jury? He was convicted of felony murder, and the jury decided that he should go to death row. Now, Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall said he is disappointed. He says there has never been any doubt that Sonny Burton has Douglas Battle's blood on his hands. And you understand the logic, because the logic is that if you decide to take part in a crime, then whatever happens in the commission of that crime, if it involves the death of somebody, that death is blood on the hands of every single person directly involved in the crime. And what the attorney general says is, Burton does not deserve special treatment because he's old. He could have been executed a long time ago, but like many death row inmates, he chose to drag his case through endless, frivolous appeals. I firmly believe he should have faced punishment imposed by the jury of his peers and upheld by a number of judges. Burton admits to entering the store armed with a gun. So this is Sonny Burton, the guy who's going to get off of death row because Governor Kay Ivey of Alabama has decided she's going to let him off death row. Inside the store, one of his colleagues, one of his accomplices, shot the man in the back and killed him. The state acknowledged that fact in response to Burton's application for a stay of execution from the U.S. Supreme Court. He didn't get it from the U.S. Supreme Court. What he got was the governor of Alabama deciding he's an old guy, we're going to let him live instead of carrying out the sentence. That is a lack of truth in sentencing in my book. If you tell the public we have a law, and when there's a heinous crime committed, on very rare occasions, the death penalty is applied to somebody who's taken part in that crime. If the jury decides, as they did in the case of Sonny Burton, that he needs to go to death row, that he needs to be executed. Fact is, Governor Ivey had a chorus of voices asking for mercy for Burton, including the victim's daughter. Now, I can't figure that one out. Burton would have been the ninth person to be executed by nitrogen gas. They started using that back in 2024. But let me tell you a couple of other details that I think make a difference. Number one, every single academic study done by liberal universities shows that when a state actually has the death penalty and uses the death penalty for the small number of cases where people truly deserve execution for the horrible crime they've committed, it reduces the amount of murder. I know there's a popular meme that says the death penalty does not deter murder. According to every single study out there, it does deter murder. Even one of President Obama's buddies wrote a whole paper about why the death penalty is morally required. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson wants to hear from you, even if you disagree. Naysayers get to cut the line at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. This segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists at Oregon Medical Centers. And our X poll that you can find at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. A man dies during a senior prank gone wrong. Happened to be a teacher. Should the teens involved still face charges? My answer to that is no. You can find the question, though, and a lot of details about why we're asking the question. It involves a Georgia case. A number of students involved, high school students, were pulling a prank at their teacher's house. He knew they were doing it. He approved of them doing it. And he went out to play his role and pretend to catch them in the act. Well, as he did, he slipped on his wet driveway. It had been raining, and he fell down in the path of a vehicle. When he was hit by one of the vehicles, the students immediately provided aid, except that they could not save his life. His family says Jason Hughes loved these students, and they loved him too, and the family supports dropping all charges. So you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Nicole, who's a naysayer. Hey, Nicole, welcome to the program. Thank you for calling as a naysayer. What do you and I disagree about that makes you one?
Well, the one that you were talking about before, the Alabama case,
yeah,
where the older gentleman is not being put to death, I guess, and you said that he committed a crime that according to federal law,
no,
he
according
was going
to state
to be
law.
Put
Nicole,
state law.
It's state law because every state has a felony murder statute, which means if you and I robbed a liquor store and you didn't know I had a gun and you didn't know that I intended to shoot the clerk, and then I shoot the clerk, I pull the trigger, but you agreed to take part in the crime, even if you had no knowledge of my gun or my intent, if I kill somebody, you're guilty of felony murder. Isn't that as it should be?
Well, actually, I have no problem like yourself. This would be the first time I've disagreed with you. I listen to you all the time.
That's all right.
And I have no problem with someone that goes out and kills someone. They're the ones that actually pull the trigger. They should get the death penalty. And like you, I think this could deter others. But this gentleman, actually, what I'm hearing you say is he's paying the price for what someone else has done. Because the gentleman that actually pulled the trigger, he got life in prison. Did I hear that right?
He did. The jury in his case decided life, and because they weren't tried together, one jury decided one thing. Juries sometimes come to different conclusions. And in the case
my
of
my husband is an attorney, I totally agree with you. I understand that. But the fairness is, and where I disagree, is that he didn't actually pull the trigger. And that's where I think that gives rise then to people that are against the death penalty saying there are mistakes that are being made. Look here, look there. And where I think we should go to make the death penalty an actual thing is not to make these kind of mistakes. That people that actually pull the trigger, that actually have intent, they need to be put to death. But when we're putting to death people that haven't done this, then we have a bunch of, that's why the news media is making a big deal out of this at this point, is because he didn't actually pull the trigger. And that's why I think this is a problem.
Do you know why I think they're making a big deal of it, Nicole? Most of the people in newsrooms in America disagree with the majority of Americans. All the polls on the death penalty say the death penalty has about 70 to 80% support. It's supported by every demographic group. And in fact, even the groups that you would suspect might disagree with it, black Americans, support it by a majority. Now, their majority may be smaller than other majorities. Women don't support it as much as men. Let me make it more complicated for you. Can I do that? Like your husband might do it. Okay, you know who Nancy Guthrie is, the lady that is suspected to have been abducted?
Yes.
Okay, so the man who abducted her is the man who committed the abduction crime, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
And I imagine that they probably plan to demand a ransom. That's been kind of weird, and we're not entirely sure what's going on there, and we don't know what's happened to Ms. Guthrie. I hope that someday she is found alive. although I suspect at this point she may well have passed away. She had medical problems. She needed medicine. So this man kidnaps her, hands him off to his cohorts, and she tells them, I've got medical problems. I need to take these pills or I'm in danger. And they don't get the pills for her. Now, should the guy who kidnapped her and actually took her away from her house, should he get the harsh punishment? Or should the people who failed to get the medical help for her, who didn't? I mean, they're still part of the kidnapping.
I love how you do this, because you're very much like my husband. You guys always give me these hypotheticals that never really, we don't know any of this happened. What I'm saying is, going back to the same thing, is he didn't actually pull the trigger. And I guess that's where I want to be able to have be able to kill people that actually pulled the trigger. And I think that we need to do it more often. And I do think it will deter. And if it's found out that through whatever reason, if that person led to the death, I have a problem with that. I think that when people knowingly kill someone, and it can't be an accidental thing, it can't be something where he handed somebody off and yes, they later died. I mean, we'd be killing a lot more people.
I agree.
Might be a little bit less.
Just out of curiosity, is your husband a liberal or a conservative?
I'm a conservative, and he's very liberal.
He's very liberal. Wow, good for you for putting up with him. And he's an attorney. Two strikes.
Well, but most of them are very liberal.
I know. Unless you talk to the prosecutor, do you know? If I ask you a trick question, you'd get it, but how many times have American voters voted down the death penalty?
I don't know.
In the modern era, in the last, say, 50, 60 years, they never have. They never have. And yet there are all these states that got rid of their death penalty. And you know what they did? They did it without talking to the people. And then you take a really typically liberal state, or perceived as a liberal state, California. They just voted half a dozen years ago on the death penalty. I mean, remember, this is a state that has the reputation of being, you know, full of crazy left-wingers. They were told, we want to get rid of the death penalty. The anti-death penalty crowd had $5 million to spend. The pro-death penalty crowd had $500,000 to spend. You know what the voters said of California? They said, we're keeping the death penalty. So when you ask, in the modern era, have American citizens, American voters ever voted the death penalty down? The answer is, they never have. It's only our elite liberal betters who've decided to take it away. Nicole, great.
The Lars Larson Show.